In the sleepy sunshine of a winter afternoon, a reverie where a sea alight with flowers and bright candles washed over my ankles. The next table was crowded with animal bones. I picked one up lightly before shivering and hurriedly putting it down. It felt like the bone was reading me.
"Those are for auguring, Dikri, for scrying futures,"
wheedled a matronly-looking being. She had wings pinioned to her back that were dull gold and edged in fire. "I'm not interested," I said, thinking of my own horoscope.
"What about a love charm, then?" persisted the owner, pushing a flower carved of pearl to me. "To awaken your lover's interest," she added with a wink.
At this, Amar walked to the table and slid the flower rather ungently back toward the owner.
"I am her husband. She needs no charm to hold my interest."
At the sight of Amar, the shopkeeper grabbed the flower and bowed repeatedly. We continued walking through the market, when I saw a being with arms banded like a snake, holding a platter of carrot halva high above his head. It was Gauri's favorite dish. The longer I looked at the halva, the more I couldn't remember the last time I had eaten. I was desperately hungry. I fought the knee-jerk urge to swipe something off one of the 100 platters of food. I was a queen now, or something like that. I had to show composure, calm. My stomach betrayed me with a loud grumble, and Amar's lips quirked in a smile.
"Have you had anything to eat all day?"
The reek of mandrake poison stirred in my memory. Somewhere between thinking I was about to die and fleeing for my life, eating hadn't factored into my plans. "It seemed unnecessary," I said dryly.
"After your brush with death, your first day should be sweet and bitter, like freedom itself."
I glanced back to the carrot halva.
"It's too late for bittersweet food."
"I can change that."
Chapter 8. The Palace Between Worlds. Trees like cursive script stretched above dark plots of earth, entwining against pale beams of ivy and sprouting flowers that turned their heads to watch us pass.
"This way," said Amar, lifting a cluster of branches.
An orchard festooned with silver trees greeted us. Amar walked through them, leading me toward a grove of 5 trees. The first had emerald bark, the second sapphire, the third ruby, the fourth quartz, and the fifth pearl. Sparkling fruits hung beneath their dark branches.
"Pick one," said Amar, plucking a shining sapphire.
I winced, waiting for his teeth to chip and clang against the rind. But his teeth sank into the sapphire fruit, and juice dribbled between his fingers. I was still suspicious, but I reached into the pearl tree and pulled out a fat fruit with spherical markings. It was light in my hands, as if hollow. Slowly, I bit into it. The pearl fruit tasted like warm chestnut, ripe pears, and rich honey. I sighed, devouring it core and stem before eyeing the other trees. Just as I was reaching back into the pearl tree, a ruff of feathers brushed against my fingertips, followed by an indignant hoot. I barely had time to jump back when Amar's shadow fell over me and his hand encircled the small of my back.
"They're just chakra birds," he said in a low voice, close to my neck,
close enough to drink in the scent of him, mint and smoke, cardamom and wood. He stepped toward the tree, lifting the branches to reveal 4 pairs of narrowed orange eyes.
"Rather grumpy birds. They think the moon belongs to them," said Amar.
"But irritable or not, they're harmless. Not like some of the other things here."
I turned to look into his face, but he quickly stepped away, revealing the awning dark behind him. No silvery branches arced in those shadows. The tangle of brambles and fallen stones had the unmistakable gloom of something avoided, and for good reason. The dark was more than impenetrable. It was sticky, as if it would devour whatever fell into its path. Something swayed in the distance, catching in the darkness, and though I wanted to convince myself otherwise, whatever hung beneath the disquieting trees looked an awful lot like bodies. Not everything wants the boundaries of the other world and human realm maintained. Why not? He was silent, and I wondered whether the pull of the other world kept him from responding. Finally, he said, "Because not everything respects balance. Not everything wants to be contained to one side or the other. Some things crave the chaos." I thought back to the woman in my room, the way the darkness glommed around her, choking off all the light. Her voice needled at the back of my mind. "I need you to lead me." "We must leave," said Amar, his voice cutting through my thoughts. We left behind the sparkling fruits and yawning shadows and traveled back to the night bazaar slice of day. The water buffalo lumbered to Amar's side, pushing its nose into the palm of his hand. "Are you ready?" asked Amar. I took in one last glance. The night bazaar had ensnared me. I could smell its perfume on my skin, of stories and secrets, flashing teeth and slow smiles. In the arms of this land, I was no stronger than a calf in a lion's jaws, but I liked it. Even though I couldn't admit it aloud, even though I comforted myself that I had no choice but to go with him, the truth was that I wanted this. I yearned to draw breath beneath a split sky leaking with magic, and not just live within one of the other realm's strange kingdoms, but rule it. Without answering, I lifted myself onto the water buffalo's back. Amar bowed his head, another ghost of a smile at his lips. The animal took off at a brisk pace, and my heart raced. My head bowed against the harsh wind as we sped down the same tunnel we used to reach the night bazaar. When the wind died down, I turned, expecting to see the ghost lights of its torn sky. Instead, there was only a gnarled parijat tree. Its thick trunk clung to the hill and sparse branches twisted into the sky like wrought iron. "Welcome to Akaran," said Amar as the water buffalo moved down the hill and the palace came into view. This was Akaran? After seeing the night bazaar, I'd expected another crowded city filled with thin, otherworldly beings and strange shops. But Akaran was empty. The hill sloped into a huge, flat, gray valley. As far as I could see, there was nothing but scrubland and rock. I stared around me, but the emptiness was almost solid. There was so much space. Akaran was a world completely alone. Elegant fountains and handsome statues paved the path to Amar's kingdom, a sprawling palace adorned with ivory spires and silvery arches. Spirals of reflection pools next to stone sculptures of acacia trees fell on either side of us as we approached the entrance. "This is now yours as much as it is mine," said Amar.
"Mine?"
I breathed deeply, closing my eyes, stilling the tremble in my fingers. Every now and again I glanced at Amar, waiting for him to talk about the richness of his grounds or the costliness of his palace. Whenever I'd spied on a foreign royal's introduction to the Raja's court, the wealth of the foreigner's palace, beauty of his queens, and plumpness of his livestock always preceded his name. But Amar was different. He had said his first name and nothing after. Once we were inside the courtyard, Amar leapt from the water buffalo. I tried to do the same, but my legs felt clumsy. Amar lifted me gently, his hands lingering at my waist a moment too long before he drew them away. My face warmed, and I was glad when someone stepped out of the shadows. A clean-shaven man with a bulbous nose bowed to us. He was richly dressed, his brocade sherwani a gleaming silver next to Amar's black robes. His arms were full of scrolls that he clutched at with ink-stained fingers. He looked like the studious court archivists. I looked at him intently, waiting for something inevitably strange to happen. What was he hiding? A tail? Clawed feet? His eyes were fixed on the ground, and he lifted them slowly, as if he was fighting the moment when he finally looked at me. When our eyes met, his smile faltered. He made a strangled sound, a weird mix of surprise and disbelief. I ventured a smile, but that seemed to make things worse. The man swallowed air, his grip on the parchments tightening.
"May I present Gupta, my counselor and dearest friend?"
Gupta cleared his throat, staring at the ground.
"Welcome to the Akaran, Rani."
"Rani," I repeated in my head. I really was queen. Gupta spoke softly, his voice trailing into a nervous stuttering. It was the kind of tone Ajit had used when he disagreed with the Raja. "Does he think I shouldn't be here?" Walking to him, Amar clapped a hand against his back. Gupta stared back, his expression a mask of hesitation and wonder.
"Gupta is indispensable to the realm." "Not nearly as indispensable as some," he said, not meeting my gaze.
He rocked on his heels, examining the scrolls in his arms.
"I must excuse myself. I have matters to attend to." "Join us for dinner," said Amar. "You've never shied from eating with me before."
He smiled before adding jokingly,
"No one will judge you for trying to organize your grains of rice."
A smile flashed on Gupta's face.
"You could learn a thing or two from me the way you carry on with a plate."
But then he turned to me, and the smile slid off his face. He shook his head.
"Another time, my friend."
All of Bharata's court archivists were arrogant, but Gupta's cagey responses and narrowed glances bordered on insult. I was a princess of Bharata, not some foundling Amar rescued by a roadside. The next time he met my gaze, I raised my chin, my ears turning hot. For the first time, Gupta grinned.
"I hope you will not mind the silence of our halls, Rani."
The memory of clashing iron rang in my ears. I could still see the lips of the soldiers as they shaped their mouths around a scream.
"I've had my fill of noise," I said.
Gupta tilted his head.
"Then again, perhaps our halls will no longer be silent. The Raja has waited a long time for you."
I frowned.
"He waited a long time to marry?"
"No," said Gupta.
"He waited a long time for you. I look forward to discussing your duties tomorrow morning, Rani."
He flourished a bow to me and nodded at Amar. And then he disappeared behind a pillar. Amar sighed, rubbing his temples through the fabric of his hood. He still hadn't taken off the garment.
"Gupta is not used to company," he said. "I hope he did not offend you. He can hold a conversation for hours about sentient underwater creatures, but protocol and etiquette are beyond him."
"Perhaps that's a good thing."
"You don't care for counselors and their flowery speeches?"
"They make me suspicious. In my experience, big words ornament bad news."
"A fair observation," said Amar with a smile. "Please, follow me."
Amar led me from the antechamber to a large room filled with low-hanging lanterns. A panel of ornate mirrors covered the wall on the right, while windows filled the left. The open windows revealed a stretch of nighttime. Lanterns illuminated the room to a pale gold. In the middle of the room were two saffron-colored cushions, along with a score of small plates piled high with steaming rice cakes, bowls of hot dal, and buttery slices of naan. I stepped inside, my gaze falling on the elaborate rug wrought with the image of a huge makara. Pearling emerald silk formed its serpent body, shimmering beneath the lights, so that for a moment the sea dragon almost looked real. Gauri filled my head once more, and I remembered the last night we spent together.
"We could have been twin stars, or makaras, with tails long enough to wrap around the ocean twice."
Amar leaned against one of the cushions.
"Please,"
he said, pushing a golden plate toward me. My half-sisters had always feigned a poor appetite, but the naan looked too good to waste on modesty. For the next hour I ate with happy abandon, my stomach warmed with dal and bursting with fullness. When we finished, a glass tray of mint tea and a bowl of candied fennel seeds appeared on the table.
"What do you think of your kingdom?"
It's beautiful, I said.
And very empty. Where is everyone?
It might even be dangerous to live in such luxury and repose.
This is no place of repose. Amar glanced outside, where a sliver of moon glimmered behind clouds.
I am at the mercy of the moon to reveal the secrets of this kingdom. Until then, you must practice what it means to rule. I will test you, as this palace will, in its own way.
I straightened in my seat.
On what?
Familiarity, you might say, his voice was low. All the usual aspects of ruling. I'll test your fangs and claws and bloodlust.
He stopped to trace the inside of my wrist, and my pulse leapt to meet his touch. I scowled and grabbed my hand back. Treacherous blood.
I'll test your eyes and ears and thoughts.
Not geography, then? I asked, half-joking.
It's useless here, he shrugged. You'll see.
History?
Written by the victors, he said with a dismissive wave of his hand. I'm not interested in one-sided tales.
Legends? Folk tales?
This time Amar grinned.
Perhaps. Do you have a favorite tale?
My throat tightened and I thought of Gowri standing outside my door and demanding a story.
Many.
And you?
All of them, except for tragedies. I cannot abide those.
In the harem, all the wives preferred tragedies. They wanted stories of star-crossed lovers. They wanted betrayal and declarations of love that ended with the speaker dying at their feet.
You don't find them romantic?
No, he said, an edge to his voice. There is no romance in real grief, only longing and fury.
He rose to his feet.
Tomorrow you can tour the palace fully. It's yours now.
His words echoed in my head. All of Akharan, its cavernous space, lush splendor, and enchanted aura, was mine. Even though I had walked through the night bazaar and tasted its fruit, my soul staggered. My joy was ghostly, like something not quite realized. I kept thinking back to the moment where I had stood with poison against my palm, where I had owned nothing, been nothing, and almost was nothing. Even with this new kingdom, my heart still focused on the one I knew before.
My kingdom, I started, hesitating.
Is it unharmed? Do you know what happened to my sister Gowri?
Amar's hands tightened at his sides.
Your sister is safe. Now come, let me show you our chamber.
Every bone in my body ached, but my nerves made me feel tense and awake. Wordlessly, Amar led me from the golden dining room through a series of hallways. I squinted into the darkness, trying to make out details or edges, but shadows concealed everything. Finally, we reached a marble door that could only be the bedroom. My pulse quickened, and for a moment I thought my nerves might make me retch the contents of my rich meal. Amar pushed open the door, revealing a room with a high ceiling and a circular bed. A translucent gossamer canopy fell from the ceiling, rippling in silken pools. Handsome borders gleamed along the edges of the wall. The rooms in Bharata's palace could have been a pauper's hovel compared to this.
The adjoining room should have anything you may need, said Amar, pointing at a tucked-away door.
He then inclined his head politely and entered a private chamber. He said nothing about sharing a room.
Maybe he was too tired or too full, or not interested. A flicker of disappointment shot through me. I didn't have Parvati's milky complexion, or Jaya's thick-lashed gaze, but I wasn't revolting. In the imposing room I felt small and ridiculous. No servant appeared to help me with my garments, but I did not mind. I was used to taking care of myself in Bharata. Strangely, there were no mirrors inside the bedroom, but one swipe of my hand across my face was enough to know how I looked. Smudges of coal had left my eyes and pooled against my temples. Groaning, I splashed my face with water and began the tedious task of removing my sari and jewelry. I felt blindly at my face, poking at my nose and stretching my cheeks taut. After 17 years, I still hadn't grown into my nose. My skin felt shiny,
and irritated bumps trailed across my forehead. I glanced down, taking stock of my narrow shoulders, sharp collarbones, and straight waist. I looked boyish. Maybe that's why he showed no interest. I walked back into the bedroom. Amar was standing by the foot of the bed, playing lazily with the cuffs of his sleeves. I tensed. That foolish disappointment was gone. "Are you frightened?" he asked. "Don't cower." I straightened my back. I would have stared him in the eyes if I could. "Should I be?" "I should hope there are more frightening things than sharing a bed with me," he said. He flourished a bow. "Did I not promise you that we would be equals? Your will is where I lay my head. I will not touch you without your permission." I moved to the bed, taking stock of the unnecessary amount of cushions. I could feel Amar's gaze on me, and rather than tossing the cushions to the ground, I stacked them in the middle of the bed. Amar followed me and slid onto the opposite side. The fire in the dais collapsed with the faintest of sighs. "A daunting fortress," he said lazily, prodding one of the pillows. "Have you so little faith in me?"
"Yes."
He laughed, and the sound was unexpectedly musical. "The dark is a lovely thing, is it not? It lets us speak in blindness, no scowls or smiles or stares clouding our words." I lay in bed, my body taut. Amar continued. "I spoke no falsehoods in the night bazaar," he said. "I would rip the stars from the sky if you wished it. Anything for you. But remember to trust me. Remember your promise." I fell quiet for a moment. "I remember my promise." After that, I said nothing. The air between us could have been whittled in steel. An hour passed before I ventured a glance at Amar. His face was turned from me, leaving only dark curls half visible in the light. Moonlight had limned his silhouette silver. The longer I stared at him, the more something sharp stirred within me, and I was reminded of that strange ache in my head, where forgotten dreams jostled for remembrance. I stared at the ceiling, fighting the giddiness dancing in my chest. I replayed the day slowly, languorously, reliving every detail, from the night bazaar's sky seamed with light, and the sensation of my teeth sinking into the fragrant rind of fairy fruit, to the splendid emptiness of Akharin. I rehashed the day again and again, wearing down the memory like a river pebble, until I had convinced my own stubborn mind that everything had truly happened, that every bit was real. Even so, what tasks did a kingdom that lay between the other world and the human realm want? And why me? Already I knew that Akharin was as different from Bharata as night to day. But there was something thrilling in its differences, a promise of change in its stone hallways. Chapter 9. A Turn of the Moon. When I woke up the next morning, Amar was gone. I stretched my hand across the bed, pressing my fingers into the side where he had slept. It was cool to the touch. He'd been gone for some time. Not a good sign for the first day as queen. I pulled at my hair, biting back a groan, and hoping he'd left while the room was still dark. My hair fell in knotted waves around me. I probably looked feral. Gray daylight puddled onto the floor, illuminating the room's golden borders and carven doors. I tilted my head up, eyes still disbelieving. Yesterday morning, I thought I would be wandering the halls of the dead. But instead, I was here.
"Rani?" came a voice from outside. I recognized the voice. Gupta. "Please dress at your leisure. I'll wait outside to escort you to the dining hall, where we can go through your engagements for the day."
Escorted? Engagements? In Bharata, I'd never lived by a schedule.
"Good. Thank you," I said, my voice wavering.
In the adjoining room, steam curled around water basins. I stared at my hair, pulling at some of the dirty strands. I might as well have never left the jungle. By the time I had washed and returned to the room, the bed had been fixed, and a brilliant green silk sari was spread across the sheets. There were heavy rings piled in a quartz bowl, a handful of bangles in another,
and dainty anklets fashioned with dangling nightingales in a third. I wrapped the silk around me slowly, savoring its length across my body. I was almost too scared to move around in it, convinced it would tear, but it didn't. My hands drifted across the heavy jewelry, but in the end I couldn't wear anything. The hollow of my throat felt cold and empty in the absence of my mother's necklace. None of this finery compared. When I walked outside, Gupta flashed the bare bones of a smile before nodding and starting off down one of the halls. Despite Akaran's coldness, the pallid corridors and mirror-paneled foyers sang to me. The same dining room from before had been laid out with a placemat set with rich foods, fruits, and water. I drew my chair to the table, stealing glances out the window toward Akaran's barren landscape. Loneliness in Akaran was worse than being stared at by the Raja's harem. At least I knew who was doing the watching. Here, even the walls were leering, weighing, and examining me.
"I trust you slept well," said Gupta.
"Yes, thank you." I glanced around the wide dining room.
"Will you be joining me?"
He hesitated. Like yesterday, he didn't meet my gaze.
"I suppose that will be agreeable."
I stopped myself from joking. I don't bite. Often. The moment Gupta sat down, he began to rub at the table, inspecting an invisible speck of dust.
"I hear Amar apologized on my behalf."
This time his voice was softer, hesitant. I froze. He had referred to Amar by his first name. I'd never once heard a counselor or advisor, no matter how close he was, call my father by his first name. They'd sooner behead themselves. Gupta's gaze was shy, perhaps curious about what I'd make of his familiarity. When I said nothing, he noticeably relaxed.
"He did, but there was no need," I said. "I think it's refreshing that you grew up away from the protocols of court speech and etiquette."
Gupta itched his hawkish nose, his eyes widening.
"You do?"
I smiled.
"It doesn't matter to me."
Gupta grinned back, and his nose spread impishly across his face.
"I'm glad to hear that, Rani."
I chewed my cheek. I didn't want to be locked in by invisible rules of caste or rank. My father's words echoed in my head. Immortality lay in emotions. If this was going to be my kingdom as much as Amar's, I needed to prove it. And that meant knowing Gupta the way Amar did. Not as a counselor or an advisor, but as a friend.
"Call me Maya."
Gupta's hands clenched and he quickly looked away. I thought I saw tears glittering in his eyes, but instead of facing me, he rubbed at a spot on the table.
"I detest dirt. Did you know there are at least 5,000 different kinds of tiny beasts in a unit of dirt? It's appalling. You can't clean it properly," he said, crinkling his nose.
"How do you know that?" I asked, torn between disbelief and laughing.
"I am the scribe of this kingdom," he said, drawing himself up. "I make it a point to know as much as I can. For instance, I once interviewed a snail that had slept for 3 years. I have also detailed the song of sun bears and translated the treatise of autumn trees. Absolutely critical things to know."
"I see. Well, I hope we can be friends." He stared at his lap.
"Once a friend, always a friend."
A sound spidered through the floor. A laugh. A trill. The ghost of another's voice. I spun around expecting someone standing behind me, but there was no one. Nothing but empty space and gleaming walls.
"What was that?"
"Or who?" said Gupta casually.
"Who?"
"I'm not sure. It could be anyone. Or anything. It could be a wind angry with its lover and dreaming of revenge. It could be the voice of a Nagini remembering her first kiss. Akaran's strange position makes it a home for a thousand voices." I remembered Amar's words from yesterday.
"Is it because Akaran lies in between the human and other world?"
"Precisely," said Gupta.
"There's all kinds of hidey holes dotted about.
There are places where you can jump and find yourself buried beneath the earth. There are pools of glass that you can swim through and find lost monsters with no names. In Akarin, things just are.
Could I see these places?
Eventually, said Gupta. But all things must wait. For the right time. For the moment when... His eyes suddenly bulged as he clawed at his throat. The moon, I thought. Gupta must be bound into silence by it, too.
I apologize, he gasped.
I know, I cut in. My hands balled into fists in my lap. I felt helpless. I could feel magic coating the air around me. It felt like starlight and a swoop in my stomach, something heatless and bright and extraordinary. And yet I couldn't know it. A mere turn of the moon, I reminded myself.
But Maya, said Gupta, leaning forward.
His eyes gleamed.
Be careful not to follow the sounds of the palace. It is a tricky thing. It will test you. It is fine to explore. The doors that cannot open to you will not do so.
He pulled aside one flap of his jacket, where 1,000 keys, of horn and bone, metal and pearl, jangled.
Look around, he said. Akarin is a land that is by nature easily accessible.
He stood up, pointing to the barren expanse around us. It hadn't changed. Not a single cloud drifted across its sky. No bird trailed its shadow on the ground. A world draped in silence.
There are places behind our doors that must never be opened. Cunning, dark things. They can sense an invitation by something as small as another person's breath in the same room.
I shivered.
The most minor acts can herald destruction?
Well, only if you get behind the doors, he said, patting the jacket flap.
Those places are locked away. I doubt you'll ever find them, but you shouldn't go looking either. Sometimes the palace sings and murmurs. Bored and tricky thing.
Gupta glanced at the scrolls on the table and his face paled.
Amar! He exclaimed suddenly. We must go. He won't forgive me if I don't take you to the throne room in time.
When Amar wasn't there in the morning, I assumed he'd left Akarin entirely. The thought of seeing him again sent a rush of heat to my cheeks. I looked at my lap, tamping down my eagerness. I'd seen enough of the harem women begging for scraps of the Raja's attention that my mind revolted against it.
Is that where he is?
Gupta nodded.
Yes, he's waiting for you.
Waiting. For me. I smiled to myself as Gupta led me through the empty corridors. Doors of all shapes and sizes dotted the halls, some of them carved and inlaid with ivory and gems, others plain slabs of dark wood. Rich rugs sprawled out beneath my feet, softer than silk, and festooned with more detail and beauty than all of Bharata's paintings combined. All along the hallway, hundreds of mirrors caught the light, but as I stood before them, they did not twin my image. One mirror boasted a plain wooden frame, splintered at the edges. When I looked through it, I saw the sands of a desert piddling out beneath an ochre sun. Another mirror, studded with sapphire, showed the reflection of a glittering port city, heavy boats with ivory prows gently rocking on a gray sea. Mirror after mirror, giving way to countries spiked with spires, turrets bursting with small ivy flowers, cities awash in color, and 1,000 skies painted in vespertine violets of anxious nightfall waiting for stars. Dawns just barely blooming pink and orange with new light. Afternoons presiding over sleeping towns. It was all here. I could have stared through those mirrors for hours if Gupta hadn't kept marching forward.
You see, said Gupta smugly. Lovely, aren't they?
And you can get to any of these places? I breathed.
Oh, yes.
Could I go?
Soon enough.
We passed the mirrors and the corridor gave way to a stone archway.
May I ask you something? I said suddenly.
You may, but I cannot guarantee I can answer it. Why does the Raja of Akaran hide his face? Is he disfigured?
So many of us hide behind our glazed words and practiced expressions. Amar is not like that. His expression leaves no room for mistake. Around you, let us say his expression would make his feelings too obvious. Give him time.
Gupta threw open a pair of doors.
This is the throne room, he said, quickly blocking my path. Gaze lightly. This kingdom is magnificent, but its power is old and runs deep, and will not hesitate to test you.
I nodded uncertainly before walking past him, my eyes widening as I took in the stark and imposing room. But what stole my breath was the tapestry covering the wall beside the dais. On the left wall, obsidian threads shimmered, forming a tempestuous ocean, streaked with foamy white waves. Rose-gold filaments arced into a bulbous lotus, and silken veins stretched into gnarled orchards. Across the tapestry's middle stretched a terrible seam, rent apart on either side like the scalloped edges of a flesh wound. Something about the tear struck me. I could feel the rip inside me, forcing me to glance down and lightly tap my wrist to make sure that it was flesh that bent my fingers and not a thousand threads. The tapestry stretched far beyond the walls of the throne room. I could feel it like a cloak around my heart.
"We'll meet again in the evening," said Gupta.
"Anything else I should know before you leave?"
Gupta grinned. "Amar is terrible at flattery."
I smiled, but I couldn't help but wonder who had been the last person he had attempted to flatter. The thought bothered me. I was never wooed by courtly speech anyway. As Gupta closed the door behind him, I heard a soft laugh by my side.
"Is that so,
Amar?" I turned to face him, my gaze tracing the emerald robes that matched my sari perfectly. Like yesterday, he wore a hood that left only the lower half of his face in view. I looked at him, and even if it was only a moment, he eclipsed the staggering pull of the tapestry.
"I'm not swayed by flattery," I said. "I think a woman could feel insulted by a compliment, but I suppose that depends on the delivery."
"I think it depends on the sincerity. If you tell a woman she sings beautifully, when she knows the sound of her voice might as well drop a slab of stone on the person next to her, then a compliment would be insulting."
I crossed my arms.
"She could think you're blinded by love."
"Or deafened."
"You seem quite learned in the art of giving compliments," I countered. "Do you give them often?"
"No. Gupta was telling the truth. I've forgotten how to pay courtly compliments," said Amar. "For instance, etiquette demands I tell you that you look lovely and compliment your demure. But that wouldn't be the truth."
Heat rose to my cheeks and I narrowed my eyes.
"What, then, would be the truth?"
"The truth," said Amar,
taking a step closer to me,
"is that you look neither lovely nor demure. You look like edges and thunderstorms, and I would not have you any other way."
My breath gathered in a tight knot, and I looked away, only to catch sight of the tapestry. The threads throbbed behind my eyes, sharp as any headache. My vision blurred, swallowing the room around me. I blinked rapidly, squinting at the threads. All I could see were that all the threads were out of place. Some had either skipped a stitch or poked out altogether. I walked toward the tapestry in a daze, my hands outstretched. I could feel the tapestry's pull, sharp as hunger, dry as thirst. Nothing would sate or slake me. All I wanted was to adjust the threads, tuck them back into place. There was an order, a pattern, like a stitching trick. I could feel it like a word balancing on the tip of my tongue, and all I had to do was... Amar's hand closed around my wrist. He moved before me, blocking the tapestry.
"Stop!"
I blinked, my head woolly. His hands were around my shoulders, drawing me to a wobbly stand.
"Did I fall?"
"That sounds ungraceful," he said, a smile playing at his lips.
He was trying to joke with me, to ward off whatever happened as though it were nothing.
but his hands were tight at my shoulders, and there was the slightest tremble in his fingers.
A graceful tumble, then?
I suggested, stepping out of the circle of his arms. I didn't need any help keeping myself upright.
I should have explained the tapestry before showing it to you. It can be overwhelming.
Amar led me to the throne, and I sank into it wearily. There was a new ache tethered inside my bones. In the haze, the pressure of Amar's hand against my arm was warm, comforting even. I closed my eyes, concentrating on the warm pulse in his fingers. When I finally felt strong enough to speak, I opened my eyes to find Amar's face mere inches from mine. I could count the immaculate stitching of his emerald hood, the stubble along his chin, and the veins raised along his hand. His eyes, as always, lay hidden, but he was so close that if I wanted, and I did, I might be able to peek.
Amar jerked backward, his jaw tightening. The tapestry is how we keep the borders between the other world and human realm safe.
He walked to the tapestry and ran his hands over the flickering threads.
Each of these threads is a person.
The threads represent people? I repeated, sure I had misheard him.
And the entire tapestry?
It's what keeps everything in order.
Everything? My brows drew together.
As in the movements of fate.
Fate is in the purview of the stars, I quipped, not without some bitterness. I had been fed that line my whole life. It was hard to forget my blind jailers in the sky, shackling me to a fate I didn't even believe. Not that it changed anyone else's mind.
Fate and order are entirely different, and one cannot rely on stars for order. Some of the threads represent the people who have fallen accidentally into the other world,
said Amar, pointing at a darkened section near the corner.
Our task is deciding which people should be allowed in and which ones shouldn't.
Why not just keep everyone out?
Some people are bound to fall into the other world. Their fate is fixed. All we can do is move between its fixed rules and change what we can to maintain a balance.
Let me show you, he said. I rose to my feet, masking a sigh of relief that my legs wouldn't give out from under me.
Touch the thread.
Chapter 10. The Boy with Two Threads. The thick silver thread resonated warmly against my fingers. I felt a tug inside my body. The next time I opened my eyes, a forest filled with tall pines vaulted above us, their shadows crisscrossing the earth in black nets. Sweet, smoky resin filled my lungs. In the distance, the fading sun silhouetted the leaves a bloody red. My heart sank. The sight of trees usually filled me with happiness, but these trees were different. Their tragedy was tangible.
Where are we?
I was still trying to find my bearings in the strange woods. Amar stood by my side, his hands clasped behind his back. He raised a finger to his lips, nodding toward the outlines of two people in the forest, a mother and son. The mother's hair fell about her shoulders, and sweat gleamed on her brow. She looked feverish. Beside her, the boy jumped along the leaves and kicked over rocks.
Is the silver thread hers? Can they see us?
Yes. The silver thread belongs to the mother. And no, they can't. This is simply the projection of the thread. Nothing we do here affects them. He picked up a rock and hurled it against the tree, but no sooner had he thrown it into the air than it reappeared by his feet.
This moment in time is fixed.
Fixed? So it's already happened?
In a way, everything has already happened, and every option has already run its course. But those multiple fates are contained in the tapestry. Our challenge is selecting the best fate to maintain a balance of peace and letting the other outcomes fall away. Time runs differently in Akaran.
But if we can't change anything about this moment, then why are we here? Amar held a finger to his lips and pointed at the woman. She was leaning against a pair of twisted trees. With their outstretched limbs and arched trunks, the trees reminded me of someone in the act of falling. I looked at the other trees and a shiver ran down my spine. Each of the trees looked human. And they were all in various shapes of collapse. Mossy knolls for braced knees, spindly twigs for overextended arms. The language of a fall.
What do you see?
I tore away my gaze. The tree reminded me of something.
A person?
But that's...
Exactly what they are, finished Amar.
This is a twilight grove, a place where the lines between the other world and human realm are blurred.
What happened to all those people?
I asked, looking at the trees in new horror.
They got stuck in the other world.
Did they ever leave?
In a way, but by the time they were freed, they were no longer the same people, and they could never return to the life they left behind.
I watched the little boy pluck a handful of flowers for his mother.
Then why are we here? Clearly the mother shouldn't leave her child behind.
My jaw clenched, my thoughts flitting to the mother I never knew, but had always wanted. Instinctively, my hand flew to my throat, fingers searching for the sapphire necklace. I kept forgetting it was gone.
Why does this need any more discussion?
I bit out.
I'll show you.
Amar held out his hand. I looked once more at the little boy before slipping my hand in his. The moment we touched, the forest sank away, replaced once more with the throne room. This time I was prepared for the dizziness, and I ground my heels into the floor to keep from swaying. Amar pulled at a dark green thread next to the silver one.
This belongs to the boy.
I looked at the thread. It was split at the end, diverging into two frays that entwined with different spectrums of color.
Two outcomes?
Two fates. Let me show you the first one. Amar took my hand in his. I blinked once and we were back inside the forest. But this time the boy was alone. My heart ached just looking at him. He stood barefoot in the woods, his hands at his sides and his eyes glistening. Tears had left wet tracks along his cheeks, and he wiped his eyes.
Amma!
Cried the boy.
No, I said, stealing my voice. I don't like this outcome at all.
Amar's hand steadied me.
Don't be impulsive.
Scolded, I forced myself to stare at the impassive outline of Amar's hooded face, my cheeks flushing. It was the closest I could get to staring him in the eye, trying to show him that I wasn't faint of heart. That I could, even if it hurt, witness this.
The boy has two paths before him. Both are great in their own way, and both depend on when his mother enters the other world.
Amar pointed to a white flag waving near the horizon.
Do you recognize that sigil?
I scrutinized the flag. A red crocodile against a white background. It was the symbol of the Ujijane Empire.
Yes.
The emperor will come this way. He will see the boy and raise him as his own. He will be a hero among his people, a warrior, both cunning and compassionate. As Amar spoke, my eyes fluttered shut. I breathed deeply and saw everything come to pass. I saw the boy training, his eyes battle-hardened. I saw him grow strong, settle disputes between neighbors, win the affection of his countrymen. I saw how each night he peered at the moon, his handsome face drawn. His mother's loss clung to him, a constant memory to live with kindness, with love. The vision sped up. I watched the boy age, listened to him tirelessly advocate for his country to choose peace instead of war. But all the while, the war dragged on. Bodies piled up in the Ujijane Empire, and my heart clenched. It was not just Ujijane that suffered. On the fallen soldiers, I recognized Bharatha's crest, a lion and an eagle, both with one eye closed. My people were dying at the cost of this slow reconciliation. Only when he lay on his deathbed, his hands pallid and wrinkled, did peace heal the fractured empire. I watched his final smile fade, his eyes still gleaming hopefully before the vision faded. When I opened my eyes, my cheeks were wet with tears.
Was what I saw real?
Yes and no, said Amar softly. It's a fate hanging in the ether, merely an option, and a thread that's already run its course.
And this outcome of...
I hesitated, remembering the people strewn on the battlefields, the ones bearing my father's symbol.
Peace? Only happens if his mother slips into the other world?
Not if. When?
When?
I echoed. Amar lifted my hand and spun me in a quick circle. I blinked and found myself facing an entirely different landscape. Before me lay a village razed to the ground. I recognized the landscape. I had seen it in the tomes of the palace archives 100 times. This was part of Bharata's territory. Unattended fires dotted the horizon. My hand flew to my nose, but nothing softened the stench of war. A sharp sound caught my attention, and I turned to see the same boy, now grown up, pushing his horse at a breakneck speed over the burning land, rallying the surviving villagers together, and spearing Uji Jain's flag into the charred soil. The vision sped up. Bharata was no more. Hammers were taken to its parapets, sledges to its ancient monuments. It was like my father's reign had never existed. Everything had been swallowed up by the grown boy and the blazing war. Yet, even with my father's legacy completely erased, there was one thing I noticed. No bodies. The scores of dead from the previous vision were gone. They had survived. Revulsion twisted in my stomach. I saw the choice before me, only it didn't feel like a choice at all. Either way I looked, it was an execution. No matter what, Bharata would pay the price. In this fate, the boy becomes a mercenary. The king never raises him. Instead, he must fight to survive. But the peace he fought so hard for in the other life is much more easily accomplished in this outcome. I closed my eyes, watching this version of the boy's life unwind behind my eyes. Instead of words to unite a kingdom, he used war. He had his peace, but it was a fragile thing, born of blood, and at the cost of an entire country's legacy.
And his mother?
She slips into the other world a mere year later.
Why isn't there an option where she avoids the other world altogether?
There are some pulls of fate that no one can alter, said Amar, his voice worn. While our kingdom has great power, some fates are fixed. All we can do is move in the spaces left ambiguous. Thankfully, fate leaves most things ambiguous. The village fire heated my face, and I turned away from the flames.
Get me away from here, I said hoarsely.
My throat tightened. So this is what maintaining the borders of the realms meant. It was a cruel duty. Amar's cloak fell across my eyes. I breathed deeply, letting the black silk cut off my sight. When I opened my eyes, we were standing in the throne room. Amar drew the cloak away slowly, his fingers grazing my arm so lightly it might have been unintentional. That familiar warmth jolted in my stomach and I stepped back. Beside me the tapestry was dormant. Although it unfurled into beautiful pictures of the sky, sea, and land, my eyes kept returning to its torn seam. It looked like a wound.
What happened there?
I asked, pointing at the tear. He stilled, refusing to turn in the tear's direction. Finally, he spoke.
Sometimes a great trauma in the world can untether the threads. Hopefully the tear will never concern us again.
His voice was quiet, dreamlike, as if the tapestry were a sleeping thing he couldn't bear to awaken.
But enough of that. Only one of the boy's thread outcomes may survive. It is your decision.
Does the mother die when she enters the other world?
I pictured the Dharmaraja, the Lord of Justice in the afterlife, riding toward the boy's mother, swinging his noose to collect her soul, and taking her to his bleak kingdom to await reincarnation. Amar's lips pressed into a thin line.
No one really dies.
Death is just another state of life.
What's the boy's name?
Why'd you ask?
Why wouldn't I?
I said. Each thread has a color, and each color belongs to a person. If I'm going to make such a decision, I don't want a nameless person on my conscience.
Wouldn't it be easier to keep your victim faceless?
I shuddered. Not a victim.
What else do you call one hemmed in by fate?
Human, I said, bitterness creeping into my voice.
What about guilt, then? Why open yourself to pain?
Guilt is what makes you accountable.
Amar smiled, and I sensed that I had passed some test.
His name is Vikram. I repeated the name in my head.
You need not make your decisions now. That moment takes practice. But if the time comes and you cannot perform...
No, I said, a little too quickly. This was what I had wanted all these years, hadn't I? The chance to demonstrate that I was worthy of power? I couldn't back down now.
I can do it.
I never doubted you. My anger wilted.
Last night I told you I would test you, said Amar, stretching his hands.
Consider this our first lesson.
Chapter 11. A Bloom of Marble. He walked to the center of the room, his hand hovering over the marble tiles. The space around him shimmered. Enchantment suffused the room. The floor trembled, and in the next instant, a dusky pillar shot out from the ground. Its column ended in a delicate marble bud, fashioned like an unopened flower bloom. He lay one hand against the bloom of stone, tapping his fingers against it expectantly.
Ruling Arkadin is a strange task. In many ways, it is like balancing an illusion. You must separate the illusion of what you see and the reality of its consequences, he said. Tell me, my queen, are you ready to play with fate?
The light in the room dimmed so that the tapestry's glittering threads were all but faint shimmers.
Is that necessary? I asked, waving my hand around the darkened room.
You will learn to appreciate the shadows here. Better that you become accustomed to them now. The dark is more than just the absence of light. Think of it as a space for your thoughts.
My thoughts prefer sunlit spaces.
Then your thoughts need an education, said Amar. Allow me to enlighten them.
He thudded his palm against the stone blossom. With a quiver, the marble petals uncurled. At the center crouched a marble bird. Amar tapped the bird once, and it trembled, shaking its wings of stone and turning its head to glare at me. A small chain wrapped around its claws, rooting it to the slab.
How did you...
I started, stretching a finger toward the animated bird, when I felt a sudden heaviness in my arm. I turned to see a long sword in my grip. A flash of cold shot through me.
Go on, said Amar, gesturing at the stone bird in a bored voice. It is a mere illusion of marble. Use your sword.
And do what with it?
What do you think swords are used for? He asked dryly.
I glanced between the bird and the sword. His words were as good as an execution. I cringed. Even though it was stone, a sense of wrongness crept through me. It looked so alive.
How is this a test?
That remains to be seen. Now do as you will.
Amar unfolded his arms and his voice was a dark purr in my ear.
What's this, my queen? All your vicious speech and you are moved to mercy by a stone bird?
My grip tightened on the stone. The stone bird hopped apace. Heat coursed through my veins. I didn't even feel the weight of the sword in my arm. I raised it over my head and brought it down. Metal crunched into stone, and bile rose into my throat. I dropped the sword, shaking. I couldn't bring myself to look at the remains of the stone bird, but I glimpsed it from the corner of my eye. Shards of marble like bone slivers.
There, I bit out. I performed your test.
Amar considered me for a moment, arms crossed, lips pursed into a thin line.
No, you failed my test.
You sacrificed an innocent thing. Nausea roiled in my stomach.
But you said it was an illusion.